Hello! Welcome to Table Talk, episode 7. I'm John. I'm joined by Grant Howitt in New York City.
Hello!
And Will Blackstock in London.
Hello!
And Connor O'Sullivan, also in London.
Hello there!
And Ben Turner, down in sunny Melbourne.
G'day.
Okay, so Grant, what have you been playing?
I have been really focusing really heavily on 13th Age at the moment, which is a great D20 game. It's by the guys who did 3.5 and 4th Ed D&D. I'm running one game, and I'm in a Skype game for a second. And in my game, there was an apocalypse, but just for dwarves that have come out of the ground. They've stolen a giant beast, built a mountain on it, and the players are currently trying to hijack the mountain, which is very exciting.
Sounds cool. Will? How about you?
I haven't been doing a lot of role-playing. I've been playing games of Risk Legacy, which is a game I greatly enjoy.
How about Ben?
I've been doing a bit of both, but mainly I'm excited my Kickstarter of Shadows of Brimstone finally dropped, which lets me play cooperative cowboys fighting Cthulhu monsters in mines with portals to other worlds. It's one of these kind of board games where you have to level your character up with lots of gear and loot and different items. So, I'm deliriously Ameritrashing around the dungeons and getting very excited.
Yeah, I saw you backed something, but I didn't realise.
I may have gone both feet first. There may have been many dollars spent on this game. Cognitive bias demands that I enjoy the game, but it is actually very, very good so far.
Oh, cool. And Connor, how about you? What's your
I've been playing a lot, but I've been preparing a Vampire the Requiem game. So I'm getting ready for a game where the characters all have to basically ditch all the bodies after a pretty messy party at the Prince's, and basically have a really awkward thing where they just cannot get rid of the bodies.
So, like a farce. And,
yeah, basically. Try and see if I can make a farce.
So I've been playing Forbidden, just in case you guys were curious. I've been playing Forbidden Island and Forbidden Desert. So my son's five, and he's actually, even though the game is kind of rated, you know, recommended for slightly older, he really's been enjoying it. So it's kind of a new experience for me as a dad to kind of to play something with my son. I've been really careful not to try to introduce him to stuff too soon, but you know, I just as a gamer, I can't help. You know, but like be eager to like, oh, you're gonna have so much fun playing these things. So
the trick is, I guess, like once he grows up, he's gonna rebel against your teaching. So by the time he hits 13, he'll think games are really lame rather than thinking they're cool.
Exactly.
So
yeah.
You might want to just reverse psychology him and say, oh no, those board games. Oh no, they're shit. Don't play those. No, they're awful. And wait until he discovers them himself.
Here's a tiny set of golf clubs.
Really small set of golf clubs, like toothpick size.
Oh, well, I mean, like 5-year-old size.
Like child size, yeah. Okay. Yeah. It's better than my idea.
But there's only so many games of Uno you can play. It's a very important lesson to move them on quickly away from Uno.
Yeah.
So much Uno.
Tonight we're going to be talking about your first time, your first experience playing a game. And that could be anything. I mean, you know, any type of board game or game, whatever led you kind of into the hobby. Grant, I think this is your topic. Do you want to start off? Was there a sort of humorous anecdote?
Yeah. Well, I just think there's the first role playing game I ever saw. I think because like there's the first one I ran, the first one I played in, but the first one I ever saw, it was before Games Day 2000, and we were above Games Workshop Carlisle. It'd be about 11:30 at night, and what you'd do, the coach set off from Carlisle at about 5 in the morning to get to the Birmingham NEC at 9 a.m. ready for the opening of Games Day. And so all the kids stayed over in Games Workshop, and they really, but it just seems kind of dodgy now I said. But anyway, some of the older boys were playing a game called Vampire the Masquerade, and I had no idea what this was. I'd never heard of role-playing games before. Like, I knew Dungeons & Dragons existed, but I just thought it was a war game. And they were playing what I realise now was a very stupid Sabbat game. So Sabbat, for the uninitiated, are evil vampires. They're all about being the strongest and the toughest and the most evil and survival and things like that. And it was set on Halloween, and they were going around just being dicks to people. But there was a, and the games master said, okay, so there's a nightclub and you have to try and get into the nightclub. And a couple of players were like, I'm going to talk my way past the front door. And another couple of players were like, oh, we're going to sneak in through the bathroom windows. And I was blown away that there was a game that you could do this. It was like Warhammer, but you could do anything. And that really, really grabbed me and excited me. Unfortunately, none of my friends were there, and I didn't have a lot of friends. And so I then spent the next 5 years trying to persuade my much cooler friends in Portugal, where I lived, just to play a single role-playing game. So eventually, I think the first thing I ever ran was called Zaibatsu, which is available free online. You can get it now if you search for Zaibatsu RPG. It's not a great game, it's all right, but it's set in a Gibson-esque cyberpunk world where everything's super cool and everyone's super slick. And it's a game where there's a scenario you have to kidnap a Brazilian scientist to stop him from speaking at a symposium. And we didn't have any dice, so we used to poke a dice and had to write down what all the symbols meant in terms of numbers. And it was a clusterfuck, all told. It was a terrible session, but I had fun and my players had fun, and that was the first step on a road which has led me to be a games designer now, which is very cool.
Wow, okay. So you didn't play Vampire as your first?
No. Yeah, I mean, fun fact, I've never played Vampire the Masquerade. I was an NPC in a live game of Vampire the Requiem for a while. I played a mage called Rafferty Spinkiller because I got to pick my own name. I've never played a vampire. And looking back at it now, it's so try hard and so goth, and everyone's really tortured and it's difficult. And the system isn't especially good, honestly. Not Masquerade anyway. So I've not played in it, and like I'm still not sure whether I ever will. But it always holds this incredible allure as a game where you can do anything and be a super cool vampire who's having a really difficult life now, man.
Will, you don't have any...
It's waiting for Will to retort. Yeah,
exactly. Hey, like, I love Masquerade. It means a lot to me personally. But it wasn't my first game, you know.
What was your first game?
Like probably a lot of role players out there, I started with Dungeons & Dragons. So I was quite young, I guess maybe 9 or 10 years old, and my dad bought a copy of the Red Box because he'd been having some conversations with my slightly older cousin who was in college in the States and had been playing some D&D with his friends. And my dad was like, yeah, this seems like an activity that, you know, I could kind of maybe do with my children. So my brother and I played a very simple starter adventure. I remember I was a cleric, a dwarven cleric, and I remember that I got killed by a kobold, and that's about all I remember. I don't even remember the character's name. I think I might have done a little portrait for him, but, you know, this character sheet is lost in the mists of time, along with all my memories of it. But I had fun, and I guess somewhere, like, deep inside, it sort of stoked a tiny fire that has burned for a long time and turned into a raging inferno.
I'm always quite jealous to hear people saying like they started role playing when they were 9 or 7 someone of authority purchased them the game and said, "Here you are, you can do this. Go and do this." Whereas for me, like I started when I was about 15, and so we were all like we could have been drinking or talking to girls. I assume. I've never actually spoken to a woman. But
are they mystical creatures?
Oh, the unicorns! They're unicorns. They're terrifying creatures, and I don't understand what they want or what they're about. And shoes, I assume, are important.
That's a different thing, though.
Oh, okay.
You got to check Urban Dictionary.
Okay.
Sorry.
It would have been lovely, I think, to have that. It would have been. I'm jealous, I think, of that opportunity to have like when you're a child, when you're still allowed to be stupid, imaginative, and it's not seen as a thing of shame.
Yeah.
To play that would have been pretty rad, I think. But I turned out okay.
Yeah, absolutely. And say, I mean,
go on. Well, sorry.
Well, I was going to say, like, my dad, you know, he didn't desperately know the rules particularly well because he wasn't necessarily aware that that was a thing that was quite important for the GM. And so I think we had a map, like, on paper on squares, which you may have got with Red Box back then. And it was not a polished experience, I guess, by any stretch of the imagination. But I guess interestingly, the same cousin got into Baldur's Gate, and when we went over to see them about 2001, when it was reasonably new, he was like, "Okay, you should take my copy back with you." Then. Yeah, and so my brother and I got really sucked in to the idea of CRPGs at that time.
And there is that nostalgia thing of, as well, of being able to play a computer game around at someone's house, but like an older, cooler relative, and you find that, and then like, and it's like you've got an hour, and you just throw yourself into the game. It's absolutely incredible, and you can't just go out and buy it because you're not a grown up, you don't have money, and it remains this incredible temptation, this incredible thrill to be able. Like, the first time I played Grand Theft Auto 1 was at an older, cooler relative's house. And, I still love it because it has that almost that like a kind of sexy air of mystery to it.
Mm-hmm. Trying to wring every single drop of gameplay out of it for the period that you actually had.
Yeah, precisely.
No, just look. I don't need to use the bathroom. I don't need to. Okay, look, I'm just go away.
Fuck off, Mum.
Yeah.
I think this is kind of a revelation because speaking for Ben, I think we're about the same age, and we probably come from a time when, you know, the digital sort of forms of entertainment were much different. I mean, I think that was my first experience was with role-playing, was with an actual tabletop role-playing game. You know, the ones on the computer didn't exist then.
I think I have to disagree. I think my first game was a Wizardry on the Apple II.
Oh, wow.
Which
like
was
first
very
game ever, like
It actually could have been that thing. I was going to say it was Redbox as well. But actually, now I think about it, I think the Apple II was my dad had a friend who worked for a computer company, thought computers might be a big thing. Funnily enough, here I am now, a computer programmer. And he bought this Apple II computer with like all 48K of memory. And yeah, we had a game called Wizard. I think it was actually Wizardry 4 or something, Proving Grounds of a Mad Overlord. But it was a very simple fight a cleric, mage, thief. And you could kind of go down and, kick monsters and get treasure, loot and level, all that good stuff. And it had this instruction book, which, you know, games used to have instruction books. And in it, there was a little simple illustration.
Tell me more, old man.
Yes, on papyrus it was written.
A digital game with a paper instruction manual.
How quaint!
But the PDF was a nightmare to open in most days. it had the four basic characters with an illustration, fighter, mage, thief. Yeah, I've got all those. But then it had the four special characters. Ooh. And it had like the samurai, the lord, the ninja. And I want a ninja. Of course I want a ninja. And they didn't tell you how to get them. Because this, again, was the day and age of games aren't going to spell it out for you. So you'd level your character up and you'd gain some strength.
Games weren't the thing. You really had to work to get to wring any enjoyment out of the fucking thing.
Absolutely. And I was desperate to get a ninja, and I couldn't figure out after leveling up hundreds of levels why it turns out you had to have an evil character to have a ninja, because ninjas can't be good or neutral. So it wouldn't matter how much I level my character up, I was never going to get that ninja. And I played that game for years and years. And it's
the films of 80s America disagree with you on the evil ninja trope.
Well, absolutely. But yeah, and actually a lot of my, I think, early gaming experiences, so that with Wizardry, I obviously played on my own on the computer in dark rooms. But then a lot of the early role-playing, I did Redbox. My brother GM'd, I had the character and all the NPCs I needed to not be dead. And almost every game we played, I think I played the Ghostbusters role-playing game a heck of a lot with a really good friend of mine, another Ben, and the two of us sat together. He played all the Ghostbusters, I played the Games Master. And again, we just played sort of single characters, single person playing many characters. I don't think it was until my early mid-teens where I thought, actually, I wonder if we could get one person playing each character, then we might actually get some real role-playing going, because up to then it had been dice rolls and leveling. There's no character interaction when there's only one person running all of them, so I don't think I actually really did any, I suppose, what you call character role-playing again till probably 15-16 years old.
How about you, Connor? Did you start with digital games?
No, I guess I started with digital games. I mean, in terms of role-playing games, I was actually quite late coming into it. I was probably 18 or so before I actually heard of Vampire the Masquerade. And I was at that point where, I mean, there's a lot of terms you could use, but I was basically a proper frat at that age. So
I've seen pictures.
Yeah, you have. Exactly. And basically, I was at the right age for like Vampire the Masquerade. I just ate that up because like Anne Rice and stuff was like, this is the pinnacle of literature. At the, you know what I mean? So, but then again, I had the same problem as Grant where I was like, oh, this is amazing. I have to find people to play this with. And then they didn't exist. So it wasn't actually till I got to London that I got to play. My first game was actually with Will and some others. And I ended up GMing, I think, World of Darkness one-shot just using the Mortals system.
Oh, was that your very first game, Connor?
My very first game.
I had no idea. That was amazing. I had a lot of fun with that game.
It was really cool, actually. Yeah, I was like, oh, man, this works. So yeah, it was Will and two friends, and we just did a one-shot from, I think it was using something from the Urban Legends book. And yeah, it was awesome. And then the first actual game I played in was actually with John. It was one of his Rogue Trader games.
Yeah, that's where I met you guys.
Exactly. So yeah, I'm pretty late to the thing. I've still actually, to be honest, the amount of games I've played in to be counted on one hand, I've actually mainly GM'd pretty much everything.
It's the curse, I think. Like, if you're passionate about games, you'll end up doing more than you play. Because that's the thing. It's the same for me, because there are people who make it happen, and you say, okay, I'll run this, and it'll be great. But then actually, no one else is stepping up and running, which is always a bit sad.
Yeah, I think that's the thing. Whereas, like, I mean, I would kill to play in certain games that I really want to play, but it's just people don't like it enough to put in the effort to. You know what I mean?
It's not a zero effort thing to run a game. It's like, it's crazy. And especially like to dial it back to the first subject, to run your first session and everyone else's first session. That's a tremendous thing, because like, it's a bit awkward to show someone a YouTube video that they don't like, and that's 3.5 minutes. So like, hey, listen to this song, and they don't like it, and like, they've got to make a character, and then play for 3 hours minimum. And if that's shit, then like, you're not going to lose a friend over that, but you'll feel like a right chump doing so.
Interestingly, I'm now running a gaming group here to Melbourne. There's a few of us, but maybe not a lot of us. So trying to get everyone together, get a bit more of a pool of gamers going. And a lot of people are coming along going, I really want to play Pathfinder. And I'm like, I'm sorry, but okay, there are people running it. And there aren't enough games. So someone says, I might try and run it. I'm not sure I should, though. I don't think I'm not. I just get the book and run it. And everyone who's done it and stepped up has done absolutely fine, because all the players are also brand new. So they're not expecting some sort of brilliant plot line weaving their past together. They're just here to roll a few dice and kill a few kobolds, or get killed by a few kobolds.
And it's not massively hard to run a game. Like none of us. And we're all seasoned GMs. None of us took a class or anything. Yeah.
I actually did take a night class. It was
sorry. Yeah, of course. I remember actually. Yeah,
I'd like to say I'm not a seasoned GM as well. Actually,
I was part of your coursework, wasn't I? I remember that.
It was for my master's. There was an optional extra credits module for GMs.
I remember. Yeah, because we played Dungeons and Dragons, and then you made us fill out those forms, and there was that guy in glasses watching us the whole time.
Yeah, he's actually just scribbling. An uncle, though. He's not. He wasn't part of the. He just likes to watch.
Oh, how you got such a nice house. He just hangs out.
But you see, the thing is, like, he does the dishes when we go to bed sometimes. So he's all right, like, yeah.
We've asked him to stop, but he won't.
Just licks. Sorry, I'm getting off topic there.
Sorry, Will. I was assuming you were a seasoned GM, Will. I'm sorry, maybe I'm overstepping the mark there, because I don't think I've ever seen you GM something.
You see, I've played in games which every single one of you guys has run, but I don't think any of you has ever played in the game that I've run. John has. And maybe Ben?
No. I think I left the country before I had the chance.
Emma. Yeah, no, you have an air of a seasoned GM, though. I think
maybe seasoning.
Yeah. A seasoning air.
The smell.
Well, you NPC very well. I think that was what lured me in. But Will's one of my go-to NPCs. If I need to do a live game, or if someone's like, Grant, I need an NPC for something, and Will is top of the list, because he takes orders very well.
That is the ideal thing for a live game NPC, really.
Yeah, and also, like, you play characters well, and you understand that, you know, it's like the players are there. The players are the most important thing, rather than whatever bullshit character I made up 5 minutes before the game started. No, sorry, I spend hours coming with all my NPCs all my games. They're really carefully researched.
They're seeing behind the curtain, Grant.
No, behind the curtain. But yes, so back to the topic. John, when was your first game?
Oh, well, when you brought this up, I was thinking, like, any game, so any tabletop game. And for me, that would have been, like, really, what I consider really mundane games, like Monopoly and...
I think we all play Snakes and Ladders.
And Uno.
Yeah, or Chutes and Ladders if you're American.
But. Oh, yeah, sorry. Which makes more sense, because you don't go down snakes. That's not a thing you can do down a snake.
I understand. I always thought Chutes and Ladders was like S-H-O-O-T-S, as in like Americans and guns. But,
getting shot back to the first
game. That was a lot you longer before I realized it spells differently.
That's not a children's game, Connor. You've made a nightmarish. Yeah. Commentary on society there.
I can certainly understand like the biblical allegory of snakes being bad, and so there are ladders which you ascend towards heaven or the hundred space.
It's the lore of Samsara, right, in Hindu mythology. It was originally an Indian game.
Oh, was it?
Yeah, essentially co-opted by some Victorians, because why not steal all the culture you can get, guys?
I'm terribly sorry, you're playing this board game wrong. We'll put it in the museum. You can come and play it during the hours of 9:05 on weekdays.
Yeah, I think Extra Credits, I don't know if you guys know that show, it's kind of like a behind-the-scenes... Connor, I think you introduced it to me, but they kind of deconstruct the history of Snakes and Ladders. Mm. That's pretty interesting. But so check that out if you are interested.
We should put a link in the show notes. That's what people do on podcasts, right?
Show notes. Too much extra work.
While we're linking to things in the show notes... can I also mention that Paul Dean, your collaborator, Grant, on Paranoia, wrote a really nice thing about his first game on Shut Up and Sit Down, which was Hero Quest, which is something very passionate about.
Do we have show notes?
I'm typing them as we speak. We do have
to. I'm not sure that happened.
We kind of have two different versions of show notes, not to do too much inside baseball. But
is Inside Baseball another American game like Chutes and Ladders? I have no idea.
Yeah, you have to squeeze inside a baseball. It's kind of a hazing ritual. They play it on like 16-year-old boys growing up.
What is inside a baseball? I'm really curious now.
Just kind of,
do you ever see that movie? Do you ever see that movie Inner Space? And they get a little submarine
there or something.
Yeah, and they get Dennis Quaid and they put him in a submarine and then they put him inside of a bigger baseball player and then they play a game of rounders. It's actually a misleading name.
Like, Dennis Quaid has been banned from baseball, so they have to play rounders.
Yeah.
I'm sorry to interrupt the funny to move things back to the topic, but
that is what you are there for, John.
About where I started. So yeah, for me, I think it was probably Snakes and Ladders or whatever it was called, and Candyland and Monopoly and that kind of stuff. And so to me, that's what a board game was. And kind of like Will's experience, my parents went out and they were looking for something probably vaguely educational, and they saw, I think it was a red box of D&D and brought it home and said, here's a game to play. And I think I had a similar experience where it was like, okay, play this game, you know, and we kind of looked at the rules and tried to muddle through and figure it out, but...
Yeah, I think I remember trying to muddle through working out what a role-playing game was, definitely. I mean, my brother got the red box, that's how it all probably kicked off for me. But I remember going to Games Workshop, where I was playing, again, a lot of board games before I got into role-playing. And I remember seeing floor plans for this kind of dungeon. I thought, oh. And I said, I'd like to buy this. But it just seems to be, where do I get the rules? And I said, oh, no, there's no rules. I'm like, well, but this looks awesome, but there need to be rules, because I can't just put this on the table and play with this. I don't know what to do with it. And they had to kind of explain to me the concept. These are floor plans for just gaming. And I'm like, I have six-sided dice. I can do this, but you've got to help me out here. It took me a couple more years, I think, to figure out, they're just props, they're just accessories, this isn't a game.
I had almost the reverse experience in some ways, in that it took me a while to realise that you could play without that as well.
Yeah.
Like, having a map, having an idea of sort of 5-foot steps and things is not necessarily the only way to roleplay.
Oh, that took me a long time. I can't remember the first group that I joined where it was like, oh, this is actually about playing a role where you're... you are trying to inhabit this character versus just facing and, you know, what the stuff that you know, all the, you know, juggling encumbrance and that kind of stuff.
Yeah. As a storytelling exercise rather than a mathematical challenge.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think for me, the biggest issue it took me a while to get around was the kind of tonal side of things. So like I said, my first games that I came to this one were all the World of Darkness ones, which obviously have a very distinctive tone to them. And it's the idea that, like, you know, when I try to explain it to some friends who would be kind of vaguely interested, they're interested enough to listen to the fiction, but not to go any further than that.
Yeah.
It was trying to explain when they'd say something like, no, it's not like that. They've in the book, it's like this, and that's the way you play it. Whereas it took me a long time to get around that idea that, no, that's just, I mean, yeah, that's fine, but there's actually quite a range that you can fit into that kind of...
Precisely.
You know. So, yeah, that was a big thing for me.
And I think it's a big problem for starting GMs as well, because most role-playing games, maybe like D&D and Pathfinder are the best examples, but Vampire the Masquerade is a really good one, actually, because it has a massive amount of lore just in the core book. And, like, there's the 13 clans, and, like, depending on what kind of game, let's assume you're just playing basic vanilla Vampire the Masquerade, you have access to, I think, 7 different clans or 8 clans, like the goodies, as it were, the guys
the
who are trying...
The Camarilla who are
trying to exist in society. And so you have to learn about all these guys, and then what they think of each other, and then how vampires fit into the world, and what humans think of vampires, and the different vampire laws, and one of the things about Vampire the Masquerade is you're almost discouraged from making stuff up because there's so much lore to explore. And like by the time that the majority of people have played it, there will have been minimum 10 books written about it. You know, Player's Guide to the X, Player's Guide to the Y. There's a huge amount of lore to learn. And there's the idea that, oh shit, I'm doing this wrong.
Yeah.
Like, I have to try and use this as a reference book. And I think every GM, in my opinion, every GM worth his salt or her salt, has an awakening when they realize, actually, I don't have to reference this. This does not have to be by the numbers. We can make this up.
Yeah.
All that matters is the players have a fun time, and whatever they do, they meet a challenge. And the world is roughly consistent. And
I ran whole trilogies of Dragonlance things, and I was like, I want to kill off the NPC, but I can't because I know he's in the next book. you can have fun, but you can't kill that guy, and that guy has to go there. And actually, you need to go south at this point because the fiction kind of demands it.
It just seems really strange. Like, I can certainly understand why it's happened, because the core idea is that it's a dungeon, and dungeons are wonderfully limited in terms of player choice. You can go north, south, east, or west. You know, or generally at the most. And it's a closed environment, and there's no NPCs, and everything has to kill you, and you take the stuff, sell the stuff, buy new weapons, go kill some more monsters. And that really works for that level of storytelling. But you get to something like World of Darkness, and it's like, it is important this NPC doesn't die, because he crops up all across our different lines. Do not kill this NPC. It's like, but the players really want to kill this guy. Well, the players really want to do this. And it seems really strange to have, because the word we have for it is adventure. To have an adventure which is entirely preordained is not adventurous. That is very safe.
Yeah. I mean, I think what they've done well, just because I've been reading a lot of it lately, the version 2 of the Requiem book that's come out.
Oh, yeah, Smoke.
Yeah, and they've actually even updated that again recently as a kind of officially, this is the second edition of Requiem. But they've done a lot of work in kind of cutting a lot of that stuff out so that here's a load of lore, but this lore is just, this isn't the lore TM. This is what this crowd thinks of it, and this is what this crowd thinks. Even down to the point of, I mean, I remember with Masquerade, and I really enjoyed it, this whole idea of, so vampires come from Cain, and Cain killed Abel, and then he became a vampire, and it goes all the way through the ages, and it's really cool. Yeah. But with Requiem, they've just gone, they might be from ancient Greece, they might be from here, they could be from there. And so you can potentially bring in some new players and say, right, you're vampires, you can do this, you can do this, you can do this, what do you want to do now? And
precisely,
it's perfectly acceptable to do that, and you're not dropping these people in a game that they have no idea what's going on.
Yeah,
you know.
Well, crucially, it doesn't matter where vampires came from; it's what these vampires are doing.
Exactly.
Now.
Yeah,
that's the point of the game.
And I mean, vampires exist far beyond the game. You know, it's not like you've made up a game about Bloggy Forps and they all do a certain thing, and
no one
has any idea what a Bloggy Forp might be beyond what's written in your fluff. Everyone knows about vampires. They never drink blood. They know. They may, even if they've never read Dracula, they've probably seen at least one vampire film somewhere along the way.
Certainly.
Or true cultural osmosis. You know, understand what a vampire is.
The same way most people can replicate the plot of Star Wars, despite having never seen Star Wars.
Or tell you that Superman is allergic to kryptonite or whatever,
even if
they've never picked up a comic. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's a bit more than an allergy, really. I feel I've sort of misrepresented that.
I'm just looking forward to the new White Wolf line of Florgiflor, the Florganine.
Yeah, well, tell us about Florgiflorbs. What are they into?
So they're kind of, they're like whatever you think is cool, but cooler.
Wow.
And yeah.
What are they allergic
to? Girls in eyeliner? But like more eyeliner?
Well, if that would be cooler, then sure. Why not? Wow.
Can you run a game of this? This sounds great.
I may have to write some fluff. I've got to be honest.
So I can put it in the show notes.
The book is not available yet. There's a Kickstarter coming. I've heard that's the way to get.
Does it start with an F or a PH?
Blorgy Florbs.
Blorgy.
With a B, yeah.
Why didn't you say so?
So if anyone's looking to get into their first game, we highly recommend Blorgy Florbs the Blorganing. It should be available on Kickstarter very soon.
That's exactly
right. Now.
It's really intense storytelling. Put a link in the show notes.
A genuine real product for real human beings.
That's a tagline.
So Grant, you mentioned something about sort of dream first sessions. I think that's kind of a...
Well,
Blorgy Florbs is a good segue to...
Is it? Okay.
As good as any.
Smooth.
Good job, Will.
Aside from Blorgy Florbs, the idea was to come up with, to talk about our first session. And then I thought it'd be nice to kind of expand that out a little bit and think about what sort of, like, what our dream first session would be and what you want. Because no one's first session, a bit like their first time having the sex. It never works out precisely as you imagine. I think.
Here we go.
Sorry, I lied earlier. I have spoken to a woman. I was joking there. But it's,
Grant,
you know,
we did this joke in the last podcast as well.
I'm going to do it every podcast, Will.
Okay, all right, sorry.
Like, to the point when I'm going to invite my wife in and then not speak to her. Anyway, it doesn't always work out the way you think. You know, it's kind of uncomfortable, there's difficulty with eye contact, no one knows what to say, and it's really strange. And I was trying to think like what the best situation would be to have in a first time role playing game, and how, if our listeners who aren't, because I don't imagine any of our listeners have never played a role playing game before, this would be a strange podcast for them to listen to. But if they have, if they've got new players coming in, how to make that exciting as possible, and whatever that dream first session would be. And for me, I would like to have a character given to me. I think character generation is a massive hurdle. Always like, because you have to try and hurriedly, whilst we're waiting for the fun part of the game to start, understand the entire setting, and then make a load of value judgments based on arbitrary decisions. Say you put stealth as a primary focus of your character, and the one mission you're playing has no stealth sections, and then actually you're useless, and you might leave thinking, man, role playing games are shit, but actually no, you chose the wrong character because you didn't have all the information. So for me, I think my dream first session. Has an engaged GM. It has someone who's willing to go with, who's willing to take on the idea that players, especially new players, will not only understand the setting, but understand the tropes of general role playing, how you're supposed to behave, how you're supposed to act, and take on whatever that player does and roll with it and take it positively. But also that they give me a character. And so, Grant, you are a barbarian. You have a great axe. Tell me about your homeland where you currently aren't. Oh, I come from a desert land. Cool, okay, write that down. And you strap a little bit of character building on a character. But all the maths, all the mechanics, all the boring bits are made. And you get a character which is optimized to work in the adventure. So you get at least given the tools to act mechanically. I think that's a big stumbling block for a lot of players. Certainly was for me. The first role-playing game I ever played in was Slay Industries, and it was Slay Industries is a Thatcherite cyberpunk game from the early 90s. It's not a good game, but the setting's lovely. The setting's very chewy for Brits, I'll say that. And the art's kind of Nine Inch Nails, and it's all very like goth and cyberpunk and very cool, dripping cool, in a kind of sketchy 90s way. But I had this notoriously. He was an asshole, the GM. He was a real dickhead when it came to being a GM. And he liked to kill off players, and he liked to not give people all the information and then delight in people dying when they didn't know what they were doing. And that extended to character gen. I spent 3 hours making a character, and I had a sneaky psychic character. And what he had was a combat game. Over and over and over, a series of highly detailed combats. And my stealth never, ever came up. I had electronic hacking, and that never ever came up. And I stuck with it because I liked the group and because I kind of liked the experience of role-playing. But if he'd said, Grant, here is a combat monster, go nuts, I would have had a much better time.
Yeah, I mean, from running, say, this group in Melbourne for the last 3 years, we've had nothing but kind of first sessions. And a lot of people were running the Pathfinder, so I was like, oh, I want to do something different. I had Savage Worlds, that was my system of love at the time, and all these different settings to try out. So I guess I've actually gone through iteration after iteration because it was always new players, maybe one or two coming back to role-playing after 10 years, but a lot of people, I don't know what a role-playing game is, sit me down, and yeah, definitely pre-gen characters helps. Actually having a real railroady plot really, really helps as well. Normally that's sort of an anathema to a good game. The thing I had the most success with actually, a Savage Worlds product called Daring Tales of Adventure, which is kind of set in the 1950s pulp. You got four pre-gen characters. They all play well together. They even advise you how to level them up if you want to do a whole campaign. But I think people get tired of the railroad tracks before you get that far. But the first adventure, yeah, you've got the slugging, chisel-jawed main guy. You've got the kind of sexy but sneaky female role. You've got the little annoying bratty kid. And then you've got the old grandfather who happens to be a mad scientist and has a jetpack. So everyone's got something really exciting, everyone's got the skill they're really good at, and it's a pulp adventure against the Nazis, and it's set in a bunch of scenes, which really let you... Because Savage Worlds has got some crunch, some rules, not a lot, but it lets you, like, the first scene is a chase, here are some chase rules, we're kind of playing a board game here, but now it's a little bit of a fight, we're having a little bit of the fighting rules, but now here are some clues, so we're actually segueing into a bit of role-playing, we're suddenly not rolling dice, what's happening now, what, you've got agency suddenly, what are you going to do, and everyone's like, oh, wow, well, I'm not moving on a grid now, I'm not, this is interesting. And it kind of really gently dips people in, showcase all the little parts of the adventure without getting into the nitty-gritty, without getting into the hard rules. And that's worked really, really well. I think that sort of approach having, and conventions have been doing this for decades now. They convention games, you sit down, you're given a character, and they've already figured the plot out. There might be a little bit of inter-party, or by the way, you're actually trying to kill this guy, which kind of spices it up for role players who played a lot. But again, they've pre-packaged, they guaranteed slightly railroaded fun adventure for 4 hours, and that gets people really into the hobby, I think.
I recently ran a game, I actually mentioned it, I think, in the last podcast, where I did a two-player, as in myself and two players, game of called Trail of Cthulhu, which was one of the detective stories that's in one of the splat books. But there were two friends who'd never played games before, especially RPG games. But what I found actually was they were actually cool with it, but I had to choose my wording very carefully. So the more I used kind of distant style, kind of third person stuff of this guy says this, instead of actually, yeah. I wouldn't say I act stuff out anyway, but instead of talking to them as a character, I would actually say like, so the police chief says blah, 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 and he tells you that you need to do X, Y, Z, as opposed to quote unquote. Yeah. You know what I mean? You know what I mean? Because of that, like, I think they felt a little less kind of weird about kind of acting around a table, and they were able to just kind of get into it. And I think that's a big thing for kind of new games like that. If you're new to it, I think that can be quite daunting unless you've maybe got tenure in that kind of area of like maybe doing improv or acting or whatever like that. So I found, but what was interesting is by the end of the session, they were kind of getting into the whole, because for them, it was just, this is just a kind of a puzzle game. We can figure this out, you know.
Yeah.
By the end of it, though, they were saying, you know, what are we doing this? Why are you doing that? And they were actually talking in their own characters' voices to a degree. I mean, you know, to a point. But that's, it was just interesting,
like,
that the language. It was interesting that it was the language that kind of really was too jarring for them at the start. And that was what kind of had to be kind of altered as they went through to kind of ease them into it.
It's like, it's not something that everyone develops. Like, one of my first GMs, a good friend of mine, Chris Taylor, who I think a few of you have met, he's been running since he was 9, and he's 29 now. And rather than actually role playing, he'll say, "Okay, the bartender says this to you," and then just drop the dialogue because he feels self conscious. And like, occasionally, like he'll smooth out into it. But I've asked him about it, and like, he still feels self conscious about performing in front of people, and that is a huge barrier to entry. I think you're right. Like, giving people the opportunity to distance themselves from the character, has that, it like, because a lot of people think of D&D and, by extension, all role-playing games as, oh, I'm going to fire magic missile at darkness, that sort of thing. Giving them the chance to say, oh, actually, I have a puzzle to solve, or I have to kill these enemies. How can I do that? I don't want to get too invested in this right now. Like, I realize this is kind of a puzzle or a challenge. Everyone can get behind solving puzzles and challenges, even hypothetically. And then once they get a bit relaxed into it, then you can have the saucy barmaid turn up, or the I don't have any other characters. Just saucy
barmaids.
You're
just stuck on saucy barmaids at the moment.
it just starts to sound like you're grooming someone at this stage.
Listen, I think the world needs more saucy barmaids. Okay, that's all I'm.
So that's a solid assessment.
All I'm finding
is Peter has sent you to the lair of the saucy barmaids. For complicated reasons.
For reasons you can neither understand nor remember. Now, discuss with them in detail their bodices.
So, yeah, I think it is important to act at the characters, but not expect them to immediately act back, and probably keep the saucy barmaids till second session.
Certainly. And having... That's the thing. Like, I think one thing I've noticed, especially with women who play role-playing games the first time, quite often they'll have that, okay, cool, I attempt to charm information out of him. And it's something like even in Paranoia, because I've had a couple of games recently where it was a woman's first ever role-playing game, and it's Paranoia, which is a fucking high ledge to climb at that point. Especially for me, especially for her, but also for me as a GM. The idea that you could leverage your wiles to get information or overcome the challenge, or the idea that maybe you fancy a character, that's not... It's strange. Like, we discussed this in the previous episode where we're getting off topic, but I think it's something that as a tangent, GM should not be afraid of saying, yeah, you know what, this character is hot, because it gives the other characters a reason to interact with them, and especially if it's a male character, make all your male characters impossibly gorgeous. That's my advice. Impossibly gorgeous and feckless.
Of course, in the entirely asexual world of Paranoia, it doesn't work quite as well, but in general, yes.
Yeah, like one of the gags we put in the new edition of Paranoia is that whenever genitals are on show, friend computer automatically pixelates them to avoid upsetting people, so no one in the party's ever seen their own balls.
I'm looking forward to it.
And that comes up more than you think.
Oh, it's surprising, and especially in my games, because there's a lot of saucy barmaids inquiring in bad cockney accents as to the state of your balls. Oh, darling, what a lovely jumpsuit you've got on. That sort of thing.
And of course, there's a glitch where someone's face gets pixelated all the time for no apparent reason.
Yeah, Johnny Ballface, yeah.
Will, did you want to comment on your dream first session before we go any further?
Okay, absolutely. So basically, I think that like anything, like films, like books, like video games... It sort of depends on the person you're kind of trying to introduce to the hobby in a lot of ways. I think there are a lot of really fantastic films out there, and I don't really assume that people have never sort of seen a film before. But if they never had seen a film before, I would sort of say, what are you interested in? What kind of thing do you like? And I'd try and find something which I think they'd find engaging and fun and, you know, go from there. Video games, like that, maybe that's slightly more plausible. People say, I've never really played games, you know. And then it turns out that they have, I don't know, level 100 on Angry Birds. I have no idea if Angry Birds works that way, but
no, that's
I've never played.
Yeah.
Okay. And so you kind of try and find a gateway sort of for them.
Yeah.
The biggest challenge I've had is my fiance, who loathes the idea of games, I think, in a fairly big way. And so... She's passionate about history. She likes the sort of Victorian era. And I tried to find a game. It was a Victorian vampire kind of game that she could kind of get involved with. But she's very introverted, and she didn't completely understand the idea of character creation. And during the session that we played, the one session, she was very quiet. She didn't really get involved.
Yeah.
And if I had the chance to do it over again, and this was 8 years ago when we met, you know, I guess I would find something even lighter, you know, maybe a similar kind of idea, like, hey, we're going to kind of look at the events of maybe Pride and Prejudice, which is one of her favourite books, and one of mine as well, We're going to look at this like in a slightly different way. So how would you try and seduce this character who's maybe a little bit like Mr. Darcy?
Yeah.
Because that would work for her. Mm-hmm. So that obviously, I'm not saying your first game should always be seducing Mr. Darcy.
Always. So, everyone's first game should be seducing Mr. Darcy. It sounds great.
It is the default scenario of Blorgy Flops, the beginning coming up.
It comes with the Colin Firth, like Stan Lee or something.
Yes, it does, John. Yes, tall. That's right.
Tall and Colin Firth is in real life.
Yep.
I'll say I've tricked many friends into LARPing by essentially saying it's a murder mystery evening. There's a couple of rules, by the way.
Yeah.
Well,
people
love dressing
up. Shambo, yeah.
Exactly. People understand that as an idea, a thing that adults would do on purpose with their free time, and they'd have a bit of fun with it, and it would be a casual sort of thing. They wouldn't get really invested in it, and crucially, there wouldn't be a load of rules they were confronted with that would intimidate them.
And it's marketing as well. It's marketing and framing, and that they were sold back in the late 90s as a fun thing to do, and various companies decided, actually, shit, yeah, we can make money off this. And so they managed to spin it around the framing device of getting drunk and eating nice food, which I try to do every game I'm in. Yeah. But everyone understands fancy dress parties, and you can sort of maybe dress up a little bit, and that's okay, and everyone's doing it, and it's an accessible era. It's 1920s, so like you can walk around in 1920s garb, and people won't think that you look like an idiot. People will think, oh, she's going to a party or whatever. You know, she's dolled up. You have very limited role playing, and you have again this clear objective. It's like it's who done it, who done the murder, and it's not so you're playing Duke Abelcard of Vestovia, and you wish to speak to this character about your family's estate. However, you know that this character is a vampire. Here are all the rules for vampires. And that's, it's a really clear thing. Like you can walk into a murder mystery and not play a character and actually still play the game.
Well, yeah, you get like, I don't know, 5 sentences about your character. Maybe a couple of them mention other characters that you vaguely know, and everyone else, you just kind of go, hello, I don't know who you are. I am this good guy. I have this mannerism, maybe.
I mean, that is how you talk in real life, Will.
Yeah.
I think touching on what Will said as well about the way him and his fiance were kind of looking at what she likes, I found as well what helps a lot is kind of like what TV do you like, or what style, what kind of shows do you like. So I've sold like Mutant City Blues to friends on the premise of like, oh, it's like you like CSI, don't you? You like Law and Order. This is kind of like that. This is maybe some mutants as well. But if you like kind of people like Game of Thrones, well, things like Vampire, you got tons of political intrigue into that, or you know what I mean? Like looking at that kind of side of things as well as another kind of way to kind of get people's interest for a potential first session.
There's of course a Game of Thrones role-playing game. I mean,
there's absolutely inclined. There's also I hear falling off balconies is a large part of it.
Where your characters will all die. They're trying to one up Call of Cthulhu.
But what do you guys think? Is there so say there's someone who you know or think might be interested in starting, or would be a good player, or would be a good person to introduce to the hobby? Like, is there a particular game setting or game? I mean, we've all kind of had different experiences that introduced us to role-playing games. But I mean, what kind of ticks all the boxes for this sort of really easy barrier of entry, I guess? What do you guys think?
Dungeons and Dragons.
D&D
still.
Like,
really?
It's not rules light, but there are a lot more rules light games. But crucially, the more rules light a game is, the more you have to improvise. And that's and one of the biggest problems for a player is realizing if you can do anything, then what do you do?
Yeah.
And that can be a big paralysis thing. And like they don't want to talk out of line and appear like an idiot. And I've seen this happen with people who've even like done a couple of role playing games before. Once they sit down to their first serious like campaign thing, they're worried about speaking out of line, and so they just don't say anything and just roll their dice and whatever. But Pathfinder and D&D and 13th Age and any game where you play a wizard and have a D20, it gives you this really defined list of actions. So actually, if you want, you can turn to the player's handbook and look up everything you can do in any situation.
Mm.
And of course, a good GM rolls with that, and it's much simpler, much easier, and you start ignoring big swathes of the rules and boiling stuff down.
Yeah.
But giving people that mechanical boundary for, there are monsters here, you find the monsters in this way. And also, D&D, there's no setting of D&D. Like, especially now, like, there's no default setting. They had Greyhawk for a while, but the default setting of D&D is the campaign of D&D that you're currently playing in, where your GM makes everything up, unless he or she is running out of a book. And it's just an entire game of fantasy tropes, so everyone can plug into it. And everyone can understand, well, I'm a wizard, and that's a dragon, and that guy looks a bit like a knight, so knights kill dragons, and we need to protect the villagers. And there's a cleric who can heal people, that's fine. The rogue's sneaky. Okay, and there's some orcs, and orcs are evil, so we go kill the orcs. And actually, all those things are true. It's pretty much what you believe is true. There's no alarms and no surprises in a game of D&D. And I think that's a really good first thing to have.
Yeah, couldn't say it better than that, really. I agree.
Mm. Oh, that's great. Go on.
Picking out feats is a ball ache, though, so don't make them do that.
Picking out feats, oh, yeah.
Oh, I hate picking out feats. I've been playing role-playing games for 10 years now, and if I never see another feat again, I will be happy.
No, it's foot is the singular grunt.
Oh, sorry, my apologies. Sorry, I don't. I've been in America for 7 weeks now, so I'm starting to lose.
The language is just
the mother tongue.
No, I agree. I mean, I think there's a tiny bit of consideration maybe needs to go into, like, the... I know people who just, God, hate, like, Lord of the Rings and that fantasy setting, but I think, in general, you're right. I mean, it's that structured side of things more so than the setting itself.
Yeah, giving people the space to kind of feel the abstraction, the distance between themselves and becoming a Satanist or whatever, like 80s paranoia it was.
Actually,
for
I
those
think...
people as well, it's a cathartic experience, because if you hate Tolkien and you hate Lord of the Rings, like, given the opportunity to build up a wizard and dick around, because everyone dicks around in role-playing.
That's
like,
in GTA or whatever.
Some of the one of the players in my 13th Age game, she would not read fantasy. Like, it's like, does it have dragons in it? I'm not reading that book. I hate books about dragons. And she loved killing dragons. I think it gives them the flexibility to get past, like, the stereotypically, pretty shoddy dialogue and weird plots and stories that go on too long and too much backstory. You can go, no, you know what? I'm going to set the saucy barmaid on fire and kick her out of a window. If you want to do that, I don't really agree on setting saucy barmaids on fire and kicking them out of anything. But it gives people the chance to misbehave and a chance to sort of make their own imprint. And let off that steam, I think, and let experience a fantasy world in a way which they can feel safe doing so.
Yeah,
absolutely. So to kind of quickly sum up, play something that has, like, D&D has a fair amount of rules, gives some abstraction between the player and the character, allow them to sort of say, my guy does this, or my, you know, character says this and does this. Ease them into it, and then, first of all, give them a character to play, and give them the options they have. Sort of lay that out for them, so they're not making a whole bewildering set of decisions right at the beginning. Going like, I don't know, start from a predefined story, and then during the course of the game, if I can just give a piece of advice that sometimes people forget to follow, is let them affect the world. Let them show that the decisions they made actually make a change and, like, actually change things, and that will blow people's minds. People just go, wow, okay, stuff I do actually makes a difference. And if they do come up with anything, use it. If they come up and say, oh, I've got this sinister backstory, of an evil uncle who, hated me, throw that in the mix somewhere. Find a way to work it in.
The wizard is now your uncle. The necromancer is now your uncle. Yeah.
Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah, I'm quite excited to run, like, a first session for some people now. I think that would be fun. I really like molding players in my image, so I'd like to.
I need to get the rules down for Bloggy Floats, because Kickstarter money is the best way.
The Kickstarter will be coming soon. We'll
that sweet Kickstarter dollar. It's I can't recommend it enough. So, I mean, like, unless you want to eat food, because then you'll probably want an actual job. But aside from that, it's great. I live in a tent.
So, looking forward to anything, guys? No.
I'll go. Okay. I've just recently finished backing the Kickstarter that Onyx Path put out for their World of Darkness Dark Eras book.
Oh yeah.
Which is basically their here's a load of different time periods to set your different games in. It's done very well for itself. They've got a lot of stretch goals and a lot of extra. I think it's about a 600 or 700 page book now with an extra small PDF as well. yeah, it's a beast of a book. But what's really cool is they've managed to put in some really unusual ones as well. So, I mean, you've got things like Victorian England, and you've got, or Elizabethan England, I should say, and Vikings and Stone Age and things like that. But they've also put in some ones that are a bit more unusual. Like they've done the Roanoke colony for Geist, which I'm really looking forward to. They've done Dust Bowl, kind of Depression era America with Promethean. They've done kind of Demon the Descent during the Russian Revolution and during the Cold War as well. So, like, I mean, to be honest with you, I'm not sure how feasible these things are to play, because I think, just like we said earlier on, there might be a lot of reading necessary for each player, but they look like a lot of fun to read anyway. So, I mean, I'm looking forward to getting my hands on that when it comes around.
I've picked up a copy. I don't know how his surname is pronounced. It's Paul Sedge. Paul Sedge, the guy who wrote My Life with Master, which is a great role-playing game where you play basically a load of Igors, who are devoted to a single master, and like you either die or you kill your master, and it's a very structured experience. But he writes lovely games, and he's done this. He recently put out the PDF for his new Kickstarter one called The Clay That Woke, where you play minotaurs in this kind of crumbling city of brass, and humans don't trust you or like you. And the only way you can get more minotaurs is by breeding with humans, and so you're kind of this weird underclass. You don't have a name. So you have to earn your name by doing things, and it has this really interesting system for drawing lots out of a bowl and interpreting actions. It looks like it has a really a nice reactive setting where you can make stuff up and the setting will throw it back at you. It seems really cool. So I'd like to maybe get a game of that set up. Again, I'm not sure entirely who I'd play it with, but I like the idea of playing effectively the bad guys forced to live in a good guy setting. Mm-hmm.
That's cool. Yeah, that's cool.
Anyone else?
So, a couple of things. I mean, firstly, as much as we were excited to go and run our first role-playing game, I think I've been doing that the last 3 years, trying to get the solid group together. Now I have my solid group. So one of my players has dumped Horror on the Orient Express box set on my lap, said, I want to play this. Sad. So I've been reading for the last 3 months, and I'm still only halfway through those books.
Tell us about the box set, because it's got props in it, hasn't it?
It's got props, it's got beautiful floor plans, it's got lots of handouts.
It's got a brass dagger, am I right?
No. There's like a kind of a thing you put together, that's actually been delayed, a little kind of puzzle thing you put together, but we'll have it by the time we need it, I think. So we played the 1890s set, kind of, there's a whole load of side quests, and I'm actually very, very lucky our gaming group's run, one of our gaming groups run by Mark Morrison, who's one of the authors, and I told him I was running it, I'm very excited, and he said, yeah, don't run all the side quests, you will take 2 years. So I completely ignored him, and I've done one of them in 1890s one about some evil item of clothing, you'll know when you read it. And it's great. We even got a little prop in for the evil item of clothing, and we played 3 weekends, and it was fantastic. And the new Cthulhu system's really good, very flexible, and not so annoyingly rigid. Have you failed your role? Oh, well, sucks to be you. There's plenty of opportunities to make up for failed roles, which I really like. So I'm very much looking forward to that for the next 2 years. And the other thing I quickly want to mention, the Kickstarter for Don't Turn Your Back, a Evil Hat produced board game based on Don't Rest Your Head, the role-playing game. That has just finished funding. And that, I think, is the game where I actually met Will and John playing that. And I loved it. And we were saying about, games that are hard for new players. Don't Rest Your Head's very much a GM's game for GMs to get together and play together, is how I felt. So I'm really for that's kind of worker placement, deck builder, board game, but set out the universe, which I really, really fell in love with when we were playing it. So that's me.
Great.
I'm looking forward to, I'm looking forward to Watch the Skies, which is Watch the Skies 2, in fact, which is an enormous mega game taking place in Camden in a couple of weeks. On the South Korean team, and hoping that we will be able to take over the world. Probably, maybe not start a fight with North Korea immediately, but yeah, if you're interested in mega games and things like that, visit watchtheskies.net.
Will, is this the same thing that the guys in Shut Up and Down there a while back?
It is, yes. They did one year, which was exciting. It was enough to kind of get me to go along with some friends.
Like, where they play nations and...
Yes, absolutely. Trying to deal with the aliens and things. Kind of. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Very much.
That sounds pretty badass. Yeah.
Okay, so, cool. Looking forward to that.
Okay, cool. Well, I think we should say goodnight, everyone, then. Thank you so much.
Well, so good night, everyone.
Let's close out the podcast and say good night.
Good night.
See you next time.
Night.
Sleep tight.